Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon, and thanks for taking the time to join us today as Hockey Weekend Across America, presented by Reebok, officially kicks off today through Sunday as we celebrate the game and all those involved at all levels. I'm Dave Fisher from USA Hockey, and we're pleased to finish our Golden Moment series of media teleconferences today with the 1980 Miracle on Ice Olympic team, and it should be just a terrific call. Of course, I think you know the themes of the 3 days of Hockey Weekend Across America today. Wear your favorite hockey jersey day, and we've gotten pictures from all over the country already of groups wearing their favorite hockey jersey, a great way to celebrate. Tomorrow, Bring a Friend to the Rink Day, and a new component this year is a Try Hockey for Free program that's going on across the country tomorrow. 141 rinks in 32 states are participating, and we expect 3,000 new kids to be trying the game of hockey tomorrow, so that's terrific. And then we'll finish off Sunday. We'll celebrate local hockey heroes. Rather than the typical way we've been doing these of me introducing our speakers, I thought we'd have a little fun today and bring in Dave Ogren, the executive director of USA Hockey. Of course, Dave was the PR director for the Amateur Hockey Association of the United States at that time, his first professional job back when USA Hockey had four full-time staff members. He was there on the ground with the team and saw that unbelievable moment, a series of moments when the 1980 team captured the gold medal. And without further ado, I'll bring in Dave to introduce our speakers today.
Fish, thanks a lot. And on the ground is almost an exaggeration because I was about as high above it as you could possibly be. The scorers and statisticians booth was in the rafters. But in the building, as probably another 100,000 people have claimed to be since that date, I was actually one of the legits with the individuals on this call. You know, that moment, couple of weeks, and those last few days in particular in Lake Placid, I think, are probably the most transcendent moment in the history of American hockey. It has kind of redefined our sport. It catalyzed so much growth, so much interest. And I think to this day, every time we come up upon an Olympic Games, everybody thinks back to 1980 and the Miracle on Ice. And certainly it was something that stays in the memories of all of us who were on this call, and I think changed the lives of all the individuals who are participating in it. Our first speaker is the man who stopped the puck. And when it the old adage that it's good to be at your best when it matters most, well, he lived up to that. A tremendous goaltender, brilliant in college, but probably played the best hockey of his life when the most was on the line. I'm one of the few people who legitimately can tell you that I wasn't nervous at the end of the Russian game because from where I was up top, it was clear that nothing was going by Jimmy. But Jim Craig, of course, is immortalized as the goaltender of that team, played spectacularly, and I think right now is a great time to listen to some of his recollections and his perspective on that accomplishment 30 years later. Jimmy?
Well, that's a great introduction, Dave. Thanks a lot. I'm glad that the guys didn't comment, so that thanks a lot, guys. you know, hockey's a team sport, and I think a lot of times people forget that when great players, it's really about vision and being able to count on your teammates. And I think what was great about our team is that we, in order to win and win at the level we did, we had to play as a team and make sure everybody did their job and have confidence in the players in front of you. And that's what I remember most, is having guys on that team that were used to winning, made the sacrifices it took to win, and were able to manage it through egos and conflict and just care more about winning and caring about each other than any other team or any other business I've ever been with. But my memories, my greatest memories really are being picked as one of the best athletes in the United States to represent your country and walk in to the opening ceremonies and just know that the whole world slows down and stops worrying about everything political and just gets to watch the greatest athletes in the world represent their countries. The thing I remember most, though, as the athlete is walking with my teammates out onto the ice to play the Russians and seeing all the telegrams on the walls and seeing the New York State policemen standing there and cheering us and how all of us became one of them, and as we stood to go on the ice, and I was fortunate enough to lead them on the ice, I remember before I took my first step, I looked up, and I heard the crowd chanting, USA, USA, and you know, that chant came from Lake Placid, and it was about true emotions of Americans just proud of us. And it's something that will always resonate with me. And lastly, I would say just being on that podium with all 19 of my teammates and our coaching staff and everybody who had really worked hard to get us there, listening to our national anthem and seeing our flag. So those are the memories that will last for me forever. The guys who made these personal sacrifices when really nobody believed in us. And it's just a great feeling, whether it's 10 days or 30 years later.
Jimmy, thanks a lot. It's always good to hear your voice and to listen to those recollections. Our next speaker has continued to be the visible, I think, spokesman for this team as much as anybody else over the last 30 years. It's been a pleasure to see him on some more frequent occasions. Talk about scoring a timely goal, the captain of our Olympic team, Mikey Ruzioni. Michael?
Hey, Dave. Thank you very much. Hello to everybody out there. I think, you know, I mean, Jimmy kind of touched on a lot of things. But for me, I think just the atmosphere in Lake Placid, what it was like in the locker room between periods, after games, spending time with our teammates, enjoying that kind of magical ride. It's always been a special feeling for me to have been a part of that team. I've always considered it a great honor to have represented that team and represented the opportunity to play in the Olympic Games. And anytime you put a USA jersey across your chest, it's a pretty special feeling. And to win in Lake Placid made it even that much more enjoyable. So for me, I just, like I said before, I just took great pride in knowing I was part of that moment with so many great players and so many great friends.
Mike, it's the shortest I've ever heard you speak.
Jimmy covered most of it.
We'll get some questions to you later. We are very fortunate today to be joined by Al Michaels. I'm saying this now for the third individual in a row here, but talk about being in the right place at the right time. We have all been privileged to listen to Al over the course of 30-plus years, and, of course, most recently on NBC's Sunday Night Football. He is going to Vancouver to his first Olympics in 22 years. It is going to be great to have him back at the Winter Games. He called those great games in the arena in Lake Placid with Ken Dryden, and I think immortalized not only himself but the moment indelibly in all of our minds when he asked the question, "Do you believe in miracles?" which was subsequently answered just a short time later. Al, it's great to have you on the call and to reconnect with you. Tell us what some of your great recollections are of 1980 in Lake Placid.
Dave, thank you very much, and you summed it up perfectly, right place, right time. And all I know is that those guys, they wrote a beautiful melody, and all I did was add one lyric. So I'm just, thankful for the opportunity to have been there, but they were the fellas who pulled it off, and I think one of the motivations for me to come back into the Olympic broadcasting arena was the fact that this is the 30th anniversary of something that was so special that Sports Illustrated ranked it in 1999 as the greatest sports moment of the 20th century. And I know through the years people will say to me occasionally, "Do you ever get tired of talking about this?" And you can't. It's one of those things that's indelibly placed in the minds of anybody who was alive and can recall watching the game. And so many things in our lifetimes are memorable for the wrong reasons. If you're old enough to remember Kennedy's assassination or Pearl Harbor, and certainly of more recent vintage, the Challenger explodes after launch in 1986, and obviously 9/11. Those were terrible events, and you remember where you were and how you learned about them. And then you think of something like this, and this is all positive. It's all good. It gives everybody such a warm and fuzzy feeling. And I know that people will say to me, and I've been lucky enough through so many years in broadcasting to have done World Series and Super Bowls and NBA Finals and great championship fights, and people will say, "Well, what's your greatest sports memory? What's the best moment you've been involved in?" And I say that's the wrong question. The question should be, what's number two? Because this is this is number one by a million miles, and always will be. And it's just great to reconnect with all these guys. They brought something to this country that, you know, just at that particular time was so very important, and 30 years later still lives on.
Al, thank you. Al, incidentally, last was involved with the Winter Games in Calgary in 88 and in Vancouver. He's going to be the host of NBC's live weekend and weekday daytime coverage, and I know he's going to have one eye on that hockey monitor the entire time. Our next speaker, Jack O'Callaghan, Boston University, wonderful defenseman on a team that won an NCAA championship with Jim Craig in 1978, I believe it was, boys. And now today a very successful business person in the city of Chicago with Jack Hughes, a Harvard alum. But I think, Jack, for those of you that can't picture him in your mind's eye, just hearken back to the shot of the ecstasy on the face of a hockey player straddling a teammate on the ice with his arms thrown upwards in the air. That was Jack O'Callaghan and Mike Ramsey in 1980 after our great victory. Jack, take us back.
Hey, hi, guys. Yeah, I'm actually in Boston with Jack Hughes having lunch right now. So it's good to hear everybody's memories. You know, I have so many. It's hard to pick just one, but you know, I do remember that picture, and I remember that moment with Mike Ramsey and the excitement of everybody when we won that thing. And I think over 30 years, what's really stood out is, you know, the test of time with our friendship among the guys on the team. You know, it's as great as it was being together for those 7 months in prior to Lake Placid. I think it's been as much fun, at least, being friends with these 20 guys over the last 30 years. You know, it's every time we're together, it's still like we're in the locker room. It's a lot of laughs, you know, and I'm real excited about this upcoming Olympics. Very excited that Ryan Suter is one of the captains of that team. You know, Mike Arizioni and I this summer had dinner with these guys, the 2010 team out in Chicago, and we were talking to them. I said, you know, we've got a little bit of an Olympic Kevin Bacon theory going on here because Billy Christian and Roger Christian were on the 60 team, and Davey Christian and Bobby Suter were on the 80 team, and now Ryan Suter's on the 2010 team. So you can draw a direct link, and now that I know Al's doing the work up there as well, this is getting even more exciting. Al, you're part of the USA Hockey Kevin Bacon theory that really gives these guys maybe some good mojo going into Vancouver.
Jack, you know how to get people to say something people will write about. A very good one. Craig Patrick was the assistant coach and assistant GM of that team, and I think to this day long underappreciated for that role, and part of that's because of his low-key personality. He went on to have exceptional success as a general manager in the National Hockey League with the New York Rangers and the Pittsburgh Penguins, but I will tell you this, if there is one mischaracterized individual in the recent movie Miracle, it's Craig Patrick. He played a far more important and strategic role on that team than was credited in that film. And when people ask me, how is its accuracy? I say very, very good overall, except. And I always cite the way that Craig was portrayed in the movie. An exceptional individual from a historic hockey family. Craig, it's great to have you on the call.
Great to be here, and it's great to hear everybody's voices. It's been a while for me, so it's terrific. I, too, have many, many memories. Am I still on?
Yep, you sure are.
I have many, many memories as well, and I'm glad everybody's kind of touched on most of them, but the ones that stick out most to me, there's two that really stick out in my thinking back 30 years, and the first one is the job that Herb Brooks did. And it's well-documented and all that, but I just have to say that he had that thing planned well in advance, more than a year in advance. When I sat down with him, he told me exactly what my job was going to be, and it played out perfectly, and everything else he had planned played out perfectly. I've never seen a team better prepared in all my life in hockey, or in any sport, really, than the way that team was prepared, and that's Herb had that diagram, like I said, at least a year in advance. He had these guys play so many different systems, different forechecks, different defensive schemes, and nobody else did that at that time. And even today in the NHL, they don't do that. And the way he worked the personalities, I mean, the day I got there, on the job, he said, Craig, we've got two factions here. They don't like each other. We've got the East and the West, and the only way I know how to get them together is for me to be a tough guy, tough coach. And I need you to keep them together. You got to be the good shepherd. You got to herd them together all the time. And that's the way it played out. And fortunately for me, I got to be the assistant GM and got really close to the players, so it worked out well that way. And the other thing that really sticks out in my mind is how hard these guys worked for 7 months. I've never seen a group work that hard to get the just reward like they did. Those are my comments.
Craig, thanks a lot. Our final participant today, Bob Suter, standout defenseman, so solid on the blue line. He had won an NCAA championship in 1977, I believe it is, for the University of Wisconsin, and was just an integral part, quiet part, but an integral part of this 1980 team. And, you know, you love to see people in any business, any sport, give back. And you talk about somebody who's given back to the sport. He went back home to Madison. He opened a sporting goods store. He coached youth hockey. He's been involved as a part owner of a rink in Middleton, Wisconsin. And who could give anything back more than to have a son who's now on our Olympic team in Vancouver, as was said earlier. Ryan is going to be helping to lead the charge in just a couple of weeks for the U.S. team. Bob, give us some of your memories from 1980 and the Miracle on Ice.
Thanks a lot, Dave. I guess my biggest memories are, you know, from the time we got together in Minnesota. You know, we all lived in apartments and stuff in Burnsville, Minnesota, and the trip that it took to get to Lake Placid, you know, the trip to Finland, and we only had 10 home games, and we had to play 50 games on the road, and back then we had to fundraise a lot of our way. Every city we went to and every game we played was kind of a charity event and a fundraiser for ourselves to help fund our team and our efforts and stuff. And the harder Herb pushed us, I think the closer we got and the more stressed we were of where our position was on the team, I think the harder we worked. And getting to Lake Placid and being one of the 20 guys that got to walk in on the opening ceremonies and then be part of the next couple weeks and winning the gold medal and then being on the podium with the guys. And a day later, after we went to the White House, we all split up and kind of never talked or saw a lot of us for probably a year until we finally got together and did some different things. And like all the guys, the memories I have of, you know, the fun we had and the poking we made at some of the guys, you know, Jim Craig was my roommate for part of it, and, you know, he got the nickname Cotton. And some of that stuff just sticks with, you know, with me, and that's some of the stuff that I talk about when people bring it up. And, you know, it's every Olympics it seems to revitalize itself and how important it was back in 80 on what happened for USA hockey and for just hockey in the United States. And to be part of it is just, you know, the greatest thrill you could ever have in sports. And now having a son go is, you know, kind of the topping for everything. And, you know, it's really piqued interest around Madison and again and kind of revitalized Madison with having a couple local guys on the team with Ryan and Phil Kessel. So it's, you know, looking forward to the next couple weeks and, you know, hopefully the success continues with us. So thank you.
Bob, thanks a lot. I'll look forward to seeing you in a few weeks in Madison. And with that, let me throw it back to Dave Fisher.
Thanks, Dave, and thanks to all our speakers for those tremendous words, and we'd like to turn it back over to our operator, Rolando, to take us through the question and answer portion. We do have a limited time today, so I'm just going to ask that, yes, one question. We'll eliminate the follow-ups. If we have time for follow-ups, we'll do them, but we have about 15 minutes for questions, and Rolando, let's get us going.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press star, then one. Once again, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then one. Our first question comes from Kirk Ludyke from New England Hockey.
Talk to you today. My question for you is that when you guys took the ice on during the second period against the Russian game and you saw that Sergei Mishkin was in for Vladislav Tretiak, did that affect your approach at all for the rest of that game or not?
Who was that for, Kirk?
It's for everyone. Maybe Mike Ruzioni if he wants to jump on that one.
Yeah, I think, guys, we better just direct the question out to a particular individual because we want to give everyone a chance. So, Mike, go ahead, please.
For me and the team, I mean, the one thing that Herb kept stressing to us was for us to play our game and not worry about what the Soviets were doing. So I've always said that, they took out Mishkin, took out Tretiak and put in Mishkin. That was like taking out Patrick Roy and putting in Brodeur. I mean, he had to still be a pretty good goaltender. But as for a team, clearly it was nice to see Tretiak out of there. But it didn't affect how we were going to play. We weren't going to do anything different, regardless of who the goaltender was. We had to really worry about our own play and not really worry too much about who the goalie was for the other team. We still had to play the game regardless of the situation. And it was nothing that was really harped on. Nobody went, oh, my God, it's great, Tretiak's not playing. We still had to play the rest of those players. So I remember it being of no concern other than us just going out and playing the game that we needed to play.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Bob Wolfley with the Milwaukee Journal.
This is a question for Al Michaels. Al, since that time or in your lifetime, is there anything in American sport in terms of an underdog beating a favored team that comes close to the U.S.-Soviet Union hockey match in 80?
No, Bob, there's nothing in... I think, and certainly not at that level because, it's the Olympic Games, it's the whole world, it's the best of the best participating, considering the circumstances at that time. No, I can't think of anything of this magnitude because, the Soviets were so dominant. The Soviets had beaten the U.S. team in an exhibition game at Madison Square Garden 3 or 4 days before the Olympics began. Final score was 10-3. And also, I think a couple of things that people forget about this game, Bob, is that, number one, the Soviets outshot the United States 39-16, so that's a 2.5-1 ratio, and very rarely will you see a team in a hockey game get outshot at that level and win the game. And I know sometimes, in a highlight package where they'll put together certain moments in the game, there's a line from me that says, and finally the building has come to life. And when it comes out of nowhere, people think, well, what is he talking about? Well, the reason I said that is because the Soviets completely dominated the second period and the early part of the third, and Jim Craig kept the team in the game with some phenomenal saves. So the building was rather quiet until Mark Johnson scores the tying goal halfway through the third period. And the other thing, too, Bob, is that, how often do you see a team – in hockey overcome three deficits? People forget that. They forget 39-16 shots on goal, and they forget that the U.S. was down 1-0, 2-1, and 3-2 and came from behind to win the game. So when you put everything together, and consider what was going on in the rest of the world at that time, I can't imagine writing a script and making it any better than what really took place on February 22nd, 1980.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Matt Kalman with ESPN Boston.
Yeah, hi. If Mike Ruzioni or Jack O'Callaghan could answer this, I'm wondering if you could just speak to when you were growing up in New England, watching the Big Bad Bruins and how much that kind of impacted your hockey career and led to you guys having such great careers.
Jack, why don't you take that one?
Again, growing up in Boston, I started late. A lot of my buddies used to play hockey. I grew up right in the city. In Charlestown, Mass., right next to the Bunker Hill Monument. And, what really, really drove New England hockey back in the late 60s was Bobby Orr. I saw the same phenomenon in Chicago when Michael Jordan came to Chicago, and the town lit up like a lamp. But in Boston, I think it was even more pronounced because when Bobby Orr came to Boston and the Bruins were, after having many down years, all of a sudden they were competing for championships. They won the Stanley Cup in, I think, what is it, 69 and 71 or 70 and 71. And Bobby Orr just lit it up around New England. So it was real easy to be a hockey player once Bobby Orr came to town. And you couldn't have a greater sort of person to look to than Bobby Orr. He just kind of just lit New England up and just drove a lot of people into hockey, you know, and I think that really led to, you know, when you think 10 years later when, you know, we were all on that Olympic team and I don't think Bobby Orr just drove New England guys. I think Bobby Sutter will probably say the same thing growing up in Madison. He probably said, you know, he used to watch Bobby Orr and get excited about it. So that's what it was all about. But, you know, the other thing is, you know, I grew up playing a lot of street hockey. I mean, street hockey was big and public skating and just being outdoor handling a ball in a park and playing hockey sort of in the basketball, the outdoor basketball courts in the winter was where we really honed our skills as much as anything. So it became, once Orr came to Boston, I'll tell you, it just became the fabric of New England was playing hockey.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Brian Murphy with St. Paul Pioneer Press.
Maybe Jim Craig could address this. There's been so many books and documentaries and movies, various anniversaries. I'm just wondering if you have ever noticed any disconnect at all between your guys' story and generations of players now and hockey fans who are either born later in the 1980s or even in the early 90s now who weren't really alive to experience that firsthand. I mean, is it just as sort of rich and does it still resonate as much as it did, say, 15, 20 years ago?
No, I think we're a lot better now. No, I think where it really happens is, you know, we all do the best job we possibly can to really convey what happened there at Lake Placid. I think Craig Patrick did the best job possible. If you listen to that man what he didn't share with you is he was our player coach where a lot of us played over in the World Championships in 1979. And he was such a mentor to all of us that people don't realize that we were all trying to be professional athletes. He was a professional, and he was there, and he was the kindest, nicest man and mentor. So I think a lot of times we go and we're products of trying to bring people up to speed or help them get to where they want to go. And as the story goes, I think we've all been probably trying to be a little more humble of how hard we really worked and how much it meant to us, because the success of our team, it wasn't overnight. It wasn't luck. It was really, really hard work.
Great, thanks.
Our next question comes from Bob Duff with Windsor Star.
Hi, this is for Bob Sutter. I was actually talking to Ryan this morning over at Joe Louis Arena, and he was saying that you've kind of left him alone to kind of form his own Olympic memories, Olympic moments. You really haven't talked a whole lot about your experience other than to tell him just make sure he soaks it all in.
I have, and I've kind of done that with his whole hockey career. I mean, I coached him coming up through, but I kind of let him be his own person and kind of play the way he wanted to and help him with his skills and stuff. And as he's got on and to be a professional, I've kind of just stayed out of it. And when he asked me something, I let him know what I think or what I feel. And with the Olympics, I didn't really put any pressure on him or talk about a lot of the stuff that happened in the past with his Uncle Gary or with me, just to told him go out and work as hard as you can and enjoy the experience and get to know all the guys and the people involved and everything will take care of itself.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Craig Kustance with Sporting News.
This is a question for Jack. When kind of people break down the current U.S. roster, I think there's questions whether or not the defensemen on that team can keep up with some of the kind of powerhouse forwards in Canada and Russia. I mean, what advice would you give to, especially some of the younger guys on that U.S. team going into the Olympics this year?
I think Bobby Sutter can handle that. I think Jack's gone.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're asking a defenseman, maybe Bobby.
Yeah.
Maybe you can take that call, Bobby.
Great.
Well, I think, I mean, the guys are all playing professional hockey, and they're skating against some of the, I mean, all the top players in the world now. And yeah, there may be a few more of them on the same team, but I think, you know, they've got some great forwards on the U.S. team that are going to, you know, help them out. So I don't think it's going to be that big of an adjustment to for the defensemen to handle the speed, because they've done it now, and their forwards on the U.S. team are going to be overall better than what they're playing with now in each of their individual teams. So I think it'll be just fine.
Great. Thanks, Bob.
Our next question comes from Larry Lage with AP.
Bob, question about Ryan this morning. He said that one day he took your gold medal to school and he left it in the locker and then was thankful that the next day it was still there. Do you recall that story at all, or did he keep that from you?
No, he told me and stuff, and which was, you know, we just leave the medal around the house, and, you know, it's not locked up or anything, and it's, you know, if any of the kids' friends came over back then and they wanted to see it, it was fine, or if they wanted to take it to a neighbor's house, it was fine. I mean, it's, you know, I felt it was, you know, there for the to show people. If it's locked up and nobody ever sees it, they don't, you know, get to know about the experience. Or so with my kids, it, you know, it was fine, and, you know, we got it back the next day, and I don't think it was really a big deal.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Amy Rosewater with TeamUSA.org.
Thank you. My question is for Al Michaels. Al, kind of along the Kevin Bacon theme, can you talk about being at the Olympics and not only seeing Bob's son involved in the games, but also Mark Johnson and kind of that cycle? And do you also have a line ready for if another miracle does happen on ice?
Amy, it's a lot of fun to you know, to watch this and how it evolved. And I mean, there's so many connections here. I mean, not only that, I mean, the 1960 team won the gold medal in Squaw Valley, and the 1980 team won the gold medal. And then you have, you know, the lineage that you talked about, that several players are involved in. I mean, Herb Brooks coming so close to making the 1960 team. I mean, there are so many connections, and that, you know, that really adds to the fabric of this story and makes it, you know, richer when you go into to the detail of all of that. So obviously I'm looking forward to seeing the young Suter playing in Vancouver, but Mike Emmerich's going to be announcing the games, and I'm going to be the studio host, so there won't be any opportunity to come up with any line like that. And, you know, the great thing about something like that is when I said what I did in Lake Placid, this is before people had home VCRs and before you ever knew that something would be played back a million times. And, I mean, if I would have known that then, maybe I would have thought of something to say. And it wouldn't have sounded spontaneous. It would have sounded scripted. So I just got lucky. I was, you know, kind of at the end of an era when nobody had home VCRs and you didn't have to think about something being played back forever. And, you know, the words just came out. And those were the words that, you know, I felt from my heart were appropriate at that particular time, and you know, fortunately, they played out okay through the years.
It is amazing in this age of no TiVo, or in that age of no TiVos and VCRs, that it did last. That your comment as well.
Well, I'm lucky that it you know, and it was an amazing time too, because I mean, there was no internet. Cable TV was in its infancy. ESPN had just started, but nobody had it. There was no national newspaper like USA Today, so these guys did this at the end of an era that will never exist again, and that's what I think, you know, adds to the specialness of what took place.
Thank you so much.
Our next question comes from Jay Nanda with San Antonio Express.
Hi, guys. I have a question for Jim Craig in particular. Of course, his team is really noted for the Soviet game, and that's the most memorable thing that people think of. A lot of people forget that you had to turn around and still play Finland for the gold medal in a short turnaround. Jim, can you talk about the preparation after the highs you experienced beating the Soviets and how draining that must have been, the mental and physical preparation you still needed to come up with to beat Finland?
Well, I think it had to do a lot of how Herb recruited the guys on our team. And, you know, sometimes you can have a very talented group that are individually good. And as Herb said, you know, all-star teams fail because they don't play within a system. But I think really what happens is all these guys had won at every level. They knew that beating the Soviet was just, you know, a stepping stone to really what we wanted to do. And I know myself as a goalie, you can't make things happen. You can't get all excited. You can't run over the boards. You don't get to change every third shift with your teammates and go on the bench. So I think what it is, it really comes down to trust that your teammates are going to be prepared to do their very best. And then, as Herb says in the movie all the time, and Craig said a little earlier, and Michael and all the guys have said, is just do your job. And I think we really believed in each other. We thought that everybody was capable of doing a good job. And if you'd listen to Bobby say how his son and the team was going to prepare, these guys have played against the best. They know what it is. They're ready. Craig Patrick was saying how this team of ours was the best prepared he's ever seen in any sport. And so to go out there as a favorite was a lot of pressure. But the commitment the guys made to the ultimate goal, I think it made it so that we were ready. We weren't going to beat ourselves, and we were just going to play our game and do our jobs. And I think we did a good job at that.
Perfect. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Edward Jack with BlueShirtBanter.com.
Hello. My question is addressed to Craig Patrick. I've talked to Rob McClanahan on several occasions, and he's said that Herb Brooks was a master psychologist. Do you recall any particular moment where he used psychology on the team or even perhaps yourself?
I would say Herb, I would agree with Robbie 100%, and I would say Herb used his psychology every single day of his life, whether he was that particular year or any time. I've worked with him a lot since then, and he uses his psychology. That's his major. That was his major in college. But he was a master psychologist in terms of he tries to help anybody anytime, whether it's walking down the street or playing hockey or whatever it was. That's Herbie. So he used his assets in every walk of life.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Neil Best with Newsday.
Al, do you recall at what point you and Ken learned that game was going to be shown on tape delay in the U.S. and what your reaction to that was at the time?
Neil, I know that the way the schedule broke, there was going to be a game at 5 o'clock and a game at 8 o'clock. And as it turned out, you didn't know who was playing at what time until the very end. And that had to do with the fact that in that particular round, the number two team in one division, or one pool as they called it then, was going to play the number one team in the other. So we were two in the division that was going to play one in the other division. And that game was scheduled for 5 o'clock Eastern time. And then I know that Rune Arledge, who had a lot of influence, obviously, during those years, tried very hard to get that game moved to the night game, to the 8 o'clock game, obviously, and the Soviets were opposed to it, and so it remained at 5 o'clock. I know there was a lot of talk at that point about, you know, do you do it live, do you do it on tape, what do you do? But as far as Ken Dryden and I were concerned, it didn't matter. I mean, we were going to go out there, and we were going to broadcast the game. And you can't do it and think, well, we're on tape, or it's delayed or whatever. No, you do that as if it's live. So that really never even entered our minds that the game was on tape. But while everybody was exulting over, you know, what had taken place and the fact that it was shown at 8 o'clock, people say, well, did you go back and watch the game on tape? And I tell them that Ken Dryden and I were assigned to do every game during those Olympics, Neil. So as America's watching that game, we are doing the Sweden-Finland game.
Right.
In the arena. So it wasn't until after 11 o'clock that we got back and, you know, were able to, you know, join in the celebration.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
All right, Rolando, I think we have time for one more question if you have it.
Okay. Our last question comes from Kevin Allen with USA Today.
Thank you.
This is just a question for everybody, really. When you look back at what happened, you know, over the years, I think a lot of people have sort of developed, you know, their own idea and sort of myths of what has happened. Through the years, have there been, you know, things from that game that people think happened that never really happened, or things that you know, you don't correct when people think? I mean, obviously, a lot of people thought they watched that game live. Have any of those things come to mind for any of you?
Mike?
Not really, because when people tell me something that didn't happen, I just say, oh, that's great, yeah. I just let them enjoy whatever they think.
Yeah. A follow-up to that, I mean, obviously, that team often is cast as a team that, you know, of college guys that came together. But when you look at that team, obviously, you know, up the middle, Pavlich and Broughton and Johnson and Ruzio. I mean, it was a quality team with Ramsey and Christian. And do you think the team has gotten enough credit for how much talent they really had, as opposed to, you know, coming together at the right time and you know, posting the big upset?
Greg?
I would say that nobody really understands the amount of talent that team had. I had been away from amateur hockey for 10 years, and so it was my first glance at young American talent when we had our sports festival in Colorado Springs that summer, and I was amazed at the talent level that was there. And there was a lot of guys that were left off that team that were very talented as well. But Herb had his idea what the team makeup should be, and he, like I said, a year in advance, he knew what his team was going to be within one or two guys. So, but I was totally amazed at the talent level that existed at that time.
Kevin, can I add on
to
that?
Yeah.
One of the things, and maybe you can research this, because, you know, in 1980, there was, you know, you couldn't be a professional hockey player. And this is the one kind of thing that I've always argued with some people for over the years. You know, people always said Herb didn't pick the best players, he took the right players. But I think the right players were the best players as well. I don't think we realized how good Kenny Morrow, Mike Ramsey, and Neil Broughton and Davey Christian were going to be. I mean, who knew that Davey and Neil and Mike were going to play, 16, 17, 18 years in the National Hockey League? Kenny went four straight Stanley Cups with the Islanders and an integral part of that team. And then, you know, Magic and everybody else and Robbie and Pav and the success they had. So who knew how good they were going to become? But my question always has been, I don't think there were any Americans in the National Hockey League in 1980. 1979, maybe one or two. So in many ways, I think the players that Herb put together were the best players as well as the right players.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I'm pretty sure. I think there was a couple or three, not that many.
I mean, I know Joey Mullen was a player that Herb would love to have had.
Right, he had just signed.
And he had turned pro, but I think for the most part, you know, the guys that I'm not putting myself in Mark Johnson or Davey Christian's category, but those players were awfully good players, and who knew how good they really were going to become. So I think Craig probably touched it best when he said, you know, there were some talented players on that team that I don't think people really realized how good they were.
Thanks, Mike.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your participation today. Much appreciated. Fun to hear the memories and look back on that terrific accomplishment of 1980, and we look forward to 2010 with much anticipation as well. And thanks to the media for participating and covering not only this anniversary of the Miracle on Ice team, but also the 50th anniversary of our 1960 team and the games as we move forward in 2010. If you have any immediate needs, please call me here in the office, 719-538-1171. Otherwise, have a terrific day. Thanks again.
Hey, Suits, give me a call when you get a chance.
Okay, Marty,
all right,
thanks.
Talk to you guys.
Yep.
Bye. Hoss, I'll talk to you.
Okay, Hoss, take care. Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.